I'd like to call the meeting to order. The reason I gave a little heads up is they need, we are now being video, what's the term?
Taped.
Webcast, Mr. Chair.
Webcast.
Taped in years.
Modern stuff. Taped, yes.
You probably haven't used taped in 20 years.
So that they can crank up the machinery. That's a technical term, crank up the machinery. And now they have it going, and so there are three cameras in here, and we are being, what was the word again, webcast?
You got
webcast.
It.
Very good, okay. We have, you should have your packets, hopefully, in front of you. I apologize, some of you did not get the message that there would not be a meeting at 11, but we had time for lunch. And as usual, the cafeteria was outstanding.
Remember, you're being webcast.
I was just being dead serious here. I would like to have a motion to approve the consent agenda.
So moved, Mr.
And
Chair.
And the December meeting minutes.
We also have an addendum to the agenda.
And we have an addendum to the agenda. And I should have it here, yeah. And it is Minnesota Climate and Health Profile. And we're pleased to have Jim Kelly here from Minnesota Board of Health, or Department of Health, rather, to present that. So that in addition to the posted agenda and also the December meeting minutes.
I move approval, Mr. Chair.
There is a motion
second.
To approve. There is a second. Further discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. The motion carries. We're very pleased to have Katie Clark Sieben, I believe, joining us by telephone. Hello, Katie. Hope you're doing well.
Hello. I'm here, and I am doing well. Thank you.
Excellent. And I understand you're going to have to drop off a little bit early today, but the good news is we may be done by then.
Great. Thank you.
Are you watching us on webcam?
I am.
Ooh, that's scary. Where are the cameras?
Very good. This is really fun, huh?
It works.
Mr. Chair, we might have to reevaluate this decision.
All right. But you didn't realize that we also see you. No, yeah. And we're really, really pleased to have Adam Dunick join us today. Adam, a warm welcome to you, and we're looking forward to your presence on the board, and hopefully at some point we'll make it absolutely official.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
So,
thank you.
The floor is yours. Maybe you want to give a little background.
Sure. Happy to. Good to see some of you and meet some of you and look forward to working with you. Well, I'm serving on the EQB. I've been pleased to just want to say that I've been very happy to take over this role from Sandy Rummel, who I think did a great job for the council. And now that, at least for today, the Met Council chair job is full-time. We'll see how that plays out in the legislature. But I do plan to be on the EQB and really look forward to working with my colleagues, for fellow commissioners here, and look forward to working with the citizen reps as well.
Well, we're really pleased to have you join the Environmental Quality Board, Adam. I'm going to move beyond the chair report and go directly to Will, the executive director's report.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We've got a number of things we're going to cover, and I just want to welcome. If you have any questions during my executive director report, please feel free to interrupt me. I can clarify. In front of you here, if you see, is a copy of our budget initiative. This was included in the governor's budget that was released at the end of January. We have presented this to both House and Senate budget committees so far this session. What it's designed to do is to it's to address a couple recommendations that came from the board back in 2013 on improving environmental review It's a two-part request, and the request is a $500,000 in one-time money to support the creation of a web tool to go and take about upwards of 20,000 files, historical files, environmental review documents dating back to the 1970s, get them all loaded into a database and have them all online and publicly available real time. And so we really see a benefit to this work for both project proposer, local units of government, and citizens. And so this is part of our request. The other part is an annual request of $250,000 increase to our base, which would support two FTEs to begin to work on a mandatory category update, kind of a rolling rulemaking docket, if you will. As you recall, the legislature in 2012 assigned the board a 5-year mandatory category report that was last done in 2013. The purpose of this is to start to make those changes in rule so that we can clarify our definitions, update the categories based on feedback that we get from the general public. And even look at process efficiencies potentially too, and so that's the second part of our request. So, so far the feedback has been fairly positive, and so we'll keep you updated as this moves through the legislature. A quick legislative update: in addition to budget hearings, we've also appeared in front of a number of other committees so far in the last couple months. We presented to the House Mining and Outdoor Recreation Committees twice so far this session. Providing both a silica sand mining 101 and also a discussion and presentation on our environmental review rulemaking that's pending. And the feedback has been some general concerns have been raised about the amount of regulation at the state level on silica sand mining. But the discussion is ongoing with the legislature, and we will keep you posted. We've presented also to the Senate Environment and Energy Policy Committee a couple weeks ago on environmental review, and the committee was very interested in learning about the program and also some success stories, if you will, of where environmental review has really improved projects and helped in bringing citizen voices to decision making. A note about our silica sand rulemaking advisory panel. As you all know, we've been working on it with a panel for the better part of a year to get input on three distinct rulemakings at the board, DNR, and the MPCA. That work wrapped up last week, and so I just want to express our appreciation to the 15 panelists that served. They volunteered their time once a month for an entire day to contribute to this. I think their feedback has really helped refine some of the comments, refine some of the concepts that we're working on to develop our rules. And, you know, we do appreciate that. I also want to express our appreciation to Eric Dahl and Catherine Neuschler, Heather Ahrens, and Nathan Cooley for their hard work in managing the process. It's been a long process, but while there is some still healthy disagreements, I do think it has been a successful endeavor, and we hope that these individuals are going to continue to be at the table and have their voices heard in the conversation. So in terms of next steps for the rule, we have a survey out right now to local government units. That survey should close on March 1, and then we will do a report back to the Silica Sand Subcommittee later in March for the three agencies, kind of a debrief, if you will, of the panel process and kind of a check-in on where the rules are before we bring something to the full board for approval. So we'll work with your schedulers on trying to set up that subcommittee meeting. Minnesota Sands, as you probably heard about in the paper, we are ready to move forward with environmental review for scoping for the Minnesota Sands project. We've signed a contract with Minnesota Sands and have received payment to begin the process. Denise Wilson is our project manager. She begins on February 25th, and so we will keep you all updated as the review begins. As we indicated before, we're now webcasting, but one thing to keep in mind with the webcasting is it's not the official record for the board, and why that matters is we're only going to retain the webcast for about 6 months simply to manage the costs of keeping that much storage. So the audio recording is the official record. We'll have that going back. But if you need us to make an exception for something, please let us know, and we can do that. But otherwise, probably after about 6 months, we're going to start cutting off the webcast, the old ones.
That was the tape I was referring to.
I also want to note, in terms of website, we're going to be rolling out our climate change site in the next week. Some of you have seen a mock-up of this. This is a really well-done website that's building off of the report, the communications piece that we put out earlier in the summer. And so we're working with your communications departments and trying to advertise that. So thank you for your support there. And we're also continuing to make progress on our main site. And so as we roll these out, we will share them with you. And just wanted to thank Megan Eichen for her hard work on coordinating all these website projects. In terms of our climate work, as you know, CZO has been moving forward. Our most recent stakeholder meeting was in Mankato earlier this month. And we have another meeting scheduled in Duluth next week, and then a transportation sector meeting in Minneapolis in early March. And these events have been really well attended, and I just want to thank the commissioners and the citizen members who participated in this. Your participation has been really valuable to the dialogue. You all have expressed an interest in trying to do more outreach and more meetings in greater Minnesota, and the logistical challenge remains, and we're looking to try and have a formal board meeting out in Moorhead later this year. But I just want to point your attention to a memo here from Anna Henderson on some opportunities for some board outreach on climate issues generally. If you recall, the University of Minnesota presented to the board in December about their upcoming citizen convenings in greater Minnesota. And this effort is funded by both the Pollution Control Agency and an LCCMR grant. EQB staff will be attending these, and we'll have a resource table, and we just want to make sure that these meetings provide an opportunity for either outreach on behalf of your staff, but at least we want to make sure we're advertising the range of agency resources that are currently available to support communities and citizens on their work on climate. So we'll be working with you and your staff to try and make sure that happens. So a reminder, our next EQB meeting is scheduled for March 18th. We are planning to discuss the interagency report on oil pipelines at that meeting. We'll also be in touch with Silica Sand subcommittee members to schedule a rulemaking update later in March. And so at this point, I'm going to turn it over to counsel to provide a litigation update, and just a reminder that Leah can't provide legal advice in this setting, but can address factual questions should you have any. So,
thank you, Will. We'll save questions for you, or are there any questions for Will at this time before we go to Leah?
Thank you, Commissioner and Chair. Originally this meeting was going to be closed at the very beginning, at the outset, for a litigation update regarding Sandpiper for the EQB, but due to some changes, which I'll explain in my update, because a case was dismissed, the need for a private or closed session became unnecessary, and because the right of the public to be informed and to be fully transparent is obviously outweighs when a case is dismissed.
Can I ask a question?
We had it? Of course.
Before you get in, there was some concern as to whether was it dismissed or withdrawn, and what is there a distinction?
It was the case itself. So the question by the chair, in case it wasn't clear to the webcast, was whether the district court action was dismissed or withdrawn, and it sort of was both, because the plaintiffs that brought the action, so they go into court and say we're suing, and they bring forth the sort of complaint. They said we move to dismiss the complaint, and then the court took the action to actually dismiss the complaint. So it was with plaintiff's action that, in this case, the Friends of the Headwaters and the Minnesota Center for Environmental Advocacy were the plaintiffs in district court. They went in and said, at this point, we think this matter should be dismissed. And so they did that, and then it was officially signed days later. You're kind of cutting to the end of my book here.
Did you ask with or without prejudice, or was it?
I didn't, but that was my next question.
Okay, so the question from Commissioner Rothstein was was whether it was with or without prejudice. And dismissal can happen in those two forms. With prejudice, which I like to think of as with locks on the courthouse, meaning you can't go back in, or without prejudice, meaning it's possible that the plaintiffs could bring their lawsuit again if there's not another impediment. For example, like a statute of limitations that, you know, what if their time had expired, then they couldn't go back in. So in this case, it was without prejudice, meaning there isn't locks on the courthouse, so to speak. Okay? So just for some overall background about what we just talked about, this deals with the Sandpiper Pipeline question, which is before the Minnesota Public Utilities Commission, or PUC. In November of 2013, North Dakota Pipeline Company filed two applications with the Minnesota Public Utilities Commission for its proposed Sandpiper Pipeline, a certificate of need application and a pipeline route permit application. As the proceedings of PUC developed, the route permit proceedings grew increasingly complex and resource intensive. As such, on October 7, 2014, PUC issued an order to consider the certificate of need docket first and to hold the route permit docket in abeyance until a decision on the certificate of need was made. Now, under the applicable rules, environmental review of pipelines is completed as part of the routing permit proceeding. On October 7, 2014, PUC also ordered an environmental analysis to be conducted to help inform their consideration of need. PUC held that the environmental analysis would have to be a more tiered, broader-based analysis reflecting a high-level review appropriate to the level of detail being considered. That's the end of the quote, beginning with more tiered. The PUC asked the Department of Commerce staff to complete the analysis in time to provide for public comment as well as for use in contested case hearing proceedings. Friends of the Headwaters argued that a full EIS, or environmental impact statement, is required and sought reconsideration of the PUC's decision not to require an EIS in the certificate of need proceeding. On December 5, 2014, PUC denied that motion. Then there was the Ramsey County District Court action. So days later, on December 12, 2014, Friends of the Headwaters and the Minnesota Center for Environmental Advocacy, or MCEA, filed a case in Ramsey County District Court suing PUC and also the Minnesota Environmental Quality Board, EQB, to obtain a court order to do among them three things, among others: declaring that the Minnesota Environmental Procedures Act, or MEPA, which is Minnesota Statute 116D.04, requires an EIS or otherwise alternative review be prepared prior to granting a certificate of need for a large energy facility under Minnesota Statute 216B.243. And they wanted a court order requiring that PUC complete an environmental impact statement, or EIS, in connection with a certificate of need process, proceedings related to the Sandpiper Pipeline project and proposed by respondent North Dakota Pipeline Company. And also, they wanted, and this deals with EQB, to declare that there is no EQB-authorized alternative review for certificate of need proceedings. So those were part of the bases that they sought for bringing their complaint in district court. Those are the things they told the court they wanted. Regarding EQB specifically, the lawsuit alleged that EQB did not authorize the high-level environmental review ordered by the PUC or any other alternative environmental review at the certificate of need proceedings, and also alleged that EQB failed to exercise its authority to designate an RGU for a large petroleum pipeline certificate of need or otherwise initiate environmental review under MEPA. Now, we're going to move a little bit. Hold that thought. We're going to move now to the appeal to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. So while the case was pending and had been filed in Ramsey County District Court in St. Paul here, on January 5, 2015, the Friends of the Headwaters also filed an appeal at the Minnesota Court of Appeals to challenge the PUC's decision not to require an EIS in connection with a certificate of need proceedings related to the Sandpiper Pipeline project. Now, for big letters, note, EQB is not named in that appeal. So EQB is not a party to that appeal. Friends of the Headwaters initiated or indicated that it filed the appeal to preserve its right to appeal, but asked that the Minnesota Court of Appeals stay the appeal or sort of put it on ice while the district court, Ramsey County District Court case, was decided. On January 27, 2015, the Minnesota Court of Appeals issued an order declining to stay the appeal. The Court of Appeals disagreed with the Friends of the Headwaters' view that a provision of Minnesota Statute 116D.04 MEPA allowed it to seek review of the PUC's decision by going through this district court. They said that's not the case. Now, based on the decision by the Court of Appeals, on February 11th, Friends of the Headwaters and MCEA voluntarily moved to dismiss the Ramsey County District Court case, and the district court officially dismissed it a couple days later on February 13th. As a result, Friends of the Headwaters challenge to PUC's order will now be reviewed at the Minnesota Court of Appeals. And EQB is no longer a party to any active litigation because it's been dismissed in the Ramsey County District Court. So those are the factual update, the staff question. If you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer any factual questions. Again, if it's more for legal advice, that should be handled separately, or if, as a group, we have to do the closed meeting.
Questions for Ms. Edmund?
Well, thank you, Lee. And I'm not sure I could repeat what you just said, so I'm going to ask a question in non-legal terms.
Okay.
You've cited a number of statutory chapters that allow EQB the authority to order environmental review. My understanding is that the PUC regulates and permits, if that's the right word, utility activities under a different set of statutes, that their authorities are different than the EQB's. Almost as if the EQB has a certain path of projects within our purview that we have authority over, and somewhere at some point in time the legislature created this second track of permitting that the PUC is responsible for. I don't know if I'm even asking the question correctly. Perhaps Commissioner Rothman could backfill that question.
You need a 404 permit before you back.
Well, everything needs a 404 permit. So I guess the question I have, the traditional roles and responsibilities of the EQB, I believe those roles that you cited, evidently have less bearing on a utility project. Could you respond to that general set of observations?
Yeah, there's kind of a lot of possible questions within your question, but I think I disagree with saying that EQB would I still think of EQB as the sort of overseer of MEPA, the Minnesota Environmental Procedures Act, and they that's that 116D.04, and so as that sort of is the backdrop. EQB has gone through some changes. When it first began, there were things within its purview, and then things did get transferred to PUC, for example. But really specifically, the EQB, in terms of environmental review, the appropriateness of EIS, the granting of alternative review, that's all under EQB's authority. So although PUC, I mentioned 216, B, and that was in when they did the lawsuit, 216B.243. Those that set of statutes is with PUC. So they work in concert, and the law says to read statutes together to harmony, as opposed to reading them, as looking for one that you like better. If it's more specific, usually go to that. But you try to read them with the intent that the legislature knew what they were doing, so that they were they knew what statutes were on the books, and they tried to make them harmonious with newer statutes. So in terms of pipeline, really EQB has been watching the developments and participating with regard to environmental review all the way along. And there is a memo from 1989, which has been put in court cases, et cetera, that talks about EQB's authorities with regard to environmental review. And those are not in question. So with specific projects, when you talk about pipelines or maybe transmission lines, there are some things that have sort of come within the purview for actually being sort of the RGU, and those are done by EQB's rules, 4410, as well as EQB's statutes, 116C, 116D, really which are EQB's authorities, and then they've been given as RGUs would have for any other case through their own set of rules and statutes. Hoping I got you to the place you were looking to go.
Well, I think it gets me closer, and maybe you can answer the question. Previous projects, not this particular pipeline, but there's certainly many pipelines and many transmission lines across the state of Minnesota. They seem to have been built with less controversy. How did those projects move forward? Seemingly relatively easy, whereas this one seemingly has much more controversy.
Boy, I think you're asking sort of the $64,000 question. What makes the difference? I think public involvement, I think, was primary, and I think to look at the record or the orders from PUC, I think they were trying to, it appears from reading the orders, because I did not participate or attend the meetings, but it appears that they were trying to allow for public understanding of a complicated process and for the depth of knowledge to or sort of depth of inquiry to go to a deeper level. So in terms of why this is different than another project, I don't know that I just haven't participated in those proceedings. I don't represent PUC, so I think that's challenging. I think where this particular line is going is the preferred route location, I think, called in to some people had greater concerns over where the project proposers wanted to place the actual route of the pipeline. I think that may be fair to say.
Thank you.
Kristen?
A quick question, which is probably a little bit open. Was the question answered as to whether or not EQB has authorized an environmental review process for certificate of need? Was that question answered?
No. The district court action, which is the only one that EQB was a party to, mm-hmm. was dismissed. So before the actual district court issued any orders.
Okay, thank you.
Anything like that. Sure.
Other questions for Leo? Seeing none? Thank you. Well done. We're going to go then to item number 5 on the agenda, the designation of a different responsible governmental unit, RGU, for environmental review of Lock and Dam 1 scour repair by the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. And Caroline Magnuson from our EQB staff is here to present. Welcome, Caroline.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the board. My name is Caroline Magnuson, and I'm an environmental review staff for EQB. Today you have a decision item in front of you regarding a redesignation request for a responsible governmental unit. The U.S. Army Corps of Engineers has proposed a project on the Upper Mississippi River at Lock and Dam 1 to repair the scour holes that have developed over time. The project is necessary to protect the lock and dam from further erosion and would extend the life of the structure. The proposed project would allow filling of scour holes with rock riprap material from immediately downstream of the spillway to approximately 150 feet downstream. The rock placement would extend beyond the existing footprint in order to maintain a proper slope of rock to the dam. The proposed project requires environmental review under Minnesota Rule 4410-4300, subpart 27, Wetlands and Public Waters. Quote, for projects that will change or diminish the course, current, or cross-section of 1 acre or more of any public water or public waters wetland, except for those to be drained without a permit, pursuant to Minnesota Statutes Chapter 103G, the local governmental unit shall be the RGU. Hennepin County is the local governmental unit in this case. Hennepin County does not have approval authority or responsibility for supervising this project, nor do they have experience conducting environmental review for a project such as this. Hennepin County sent a letter to the EQB dated January 8, 2015, requesting to transfer the RGU designation to the Department of Natural Resources under Minnesota Rule 4410-0500, subpart 6. Under this rule, the EQB may designate a different RGU for the project if the EQB determines the designee has greater expertise in analyzing the potential impacts of the project. Hennepin County indicated in their letter that the DNR has a higher level of expertise needed to evaluate the potential impacts to the Mississippi River and has permitting authority over the project, as the proposed project requires a work in public waters permit under Minnesota Statutes 103G. Since the request was made, the DNR has submitted a letter to EQB indicating they have been in communication with the Army Corps as well as Hennepin County and are willing to accept the role of RGU for this project. EQB staff finds the DNR has greater expertise in analyzing the potential for environmental impacts of projects involving a work in public waters and preparing environmental review documents for such projects. EQB staff recommends adoption of the resolution and approving the findings, conclusion, and order reassigning RGU duties to the DNR.
Thank you, Carolyn. You'll find in your packet a copy of the resolution of the Minnesota Environmental Quality Board, designation of a different RGU for environmental review. You'll find the finding of fact and conclusion of law and order in the following three pages. And that should be signed by the chair of the Environmental Quality Board. I think it's fairly straight up. Tom, your staff and folks are apprised of this and have expressed their willingness to assume the RGU role. I understand.
We have, Mr. Chairman, and to that end, I'd offer the motion, the resolution.
You've heard the motion. Is there a second?
Second.
There is a second. Is there further discussion on the motion? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. The motion carries. Thank you, and I will sign the order. Thank you, Carolyn. I think I would like then, Jim, to ask Jim to come up, and Jim Kelly from the Minnesota Department of Health. Hello, neighbor. Good to see you, and Jim is here as part of the addendum to the agenda, and will present on Minnesota climate and health profile. Welcome, Mr. Kelly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the Environmental Quality Board. I'm Jim Kelly. I'm the Manager of Environmental Surveillance and Assessment at the Minnesota Department of Health, and I'm here today representing our climate and health program. Normally, you'd be seeing our program director, Kristen Robb, who's unfortunately unavailable today, so I'm here in her stead representing the program. I'm here today to share information about a recent report that we have issued known as the Minnesota Climate and Health Profile, and also to say a little bit about some of the other work of the Climate and Health Program, especially an additional report that we published last fall known as the Vulnerability Assessment. We've been conducting this work evaluating the public health impacts of climate change since 2010. We're one of 16 states and two cities that are funded by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention under a grant program to evaluate the public health impacts of climate change, and we've been engaged in that work ever since. All the states and the two cities engaged in this program are doing versions of this report that are suitable for their own geographic locations and to be designed to be of use to folks in those particular areas. We've been engaged in a number of activities, and the one I would highlight up front under this grant program was we produced a video called Climate and Health that aired on Twin Cities Public Television and was produced in conjunction with them. It aired actually on Earth Day last April and has received several airings since then. It's also available on our website. So that, in a nutshell, covers a lot of the areas that I'll be talking about today in kind of a video format. So I wanted to talk specifically today about two related reports, the first being the Climate and Health Profile that I mentioned initially, which is really an assessment of the current and future climate change impacts has been described across the scientific literature and the potential health impacts or burdens that may mean for the state of Minnesota. And really it's designed to show how climate changes are linked and can be linked to health impacts down the road. And so the report looks ahead to those and makes some estimates as to what we might be able to see in the future. We've also recently published in October the vulnerability report, which assessed populational vulnerabilities based upon current or retrospective data, so looking backwards. We use geographic information systems to display populations where locations of vulnerable populations are in our state, and also to look at the occurrence of climate hazards on varying geographic scales, and then making some efforts to overlay those where it was appropriate to do so. So I'll say a little bit more about what we found with that report at the end of my presentation. But I wanted to start with the climate and health profile. This is the report that we just released about a week ago, a little over a week ago, with a press release and posting of the report on our website, et cetera. It really provides an overview of Minnesota's geography and how our climate and our geography together present some particular climate hazards. It talks about some of the current trends in climate science and makes some projections as to what we might expect under a number of different scenarios into the future. And it really focused on a narrow set of climate hazards that we identified as most important based on our geography, our climate, and some of these trends and projections. And those are around air pollution, extreme heat, floods and drought, and disease vectors and toxins that could be associated with a changing climate. So those are the four that we're going to focus on. I'm going to talk a little bit more about each one of those in a bit more detail. The report incorporates a number of future climate projections, and that's something a little bit new for us. We hadn't really done that. We've been relying mainly on current data, of which we have a great and long history of collecting climate data here in Minnesota, and you've no doubt heard Dr. Mark Seeley from the U talk about that quite frequently in public forums and on the radio, our rich history of climate data. So we've had that to call upon, and that's been very useful. But we've also incorporated in this report some of the projections that have been developed by the U.S. Global Change Research Program, who publishes every 4 years the National Climate Assessment, which is really the state-of-the-art guidance and information on the potential for climate change, and incorporates a number of potential scenarios based on a whole variety of factors. And I know this figure is a little bit hard to see, but the main point of that is that the models rely on a very large set of complicated climate factors, geographic factors, in projections to really arrive at some of the different possibilities we might see in a changing climate into the future. It's complicated science, but it's been very well established using a variety of factors, some of the parameters that we might be able to expect. For Minnesota, some of the things that we can say with some certainty is that our temperature is rising. Things are changing in a measurable way. There are distinct daily and seasonal trends that we've been seeing. I know it's not evident today, but for instance, our winters are warming more faster than our summers. Our winter weather seasons have changed more dramatically than our summers has, and that has significant implications in and of itself. Our precipitation patterns are more extreme. We have drought and flooding occurring at the same time in some parts of the state. That's not something that's typically been part of our historical record. And we see more and more instances of 100 to 1,000-year flooding and storm events than we've seen in the past. And those are some of the factors that we're saying we need to take into account because of their potential impacts on health. The report, in its focus on those four set of climate hazards, makes the links between increased temperature and the related greenhouse gas emissions that are related to these climatological factors, leading to increased temperature and precipitation and perhaps humidity, although that one isn't quite as clear. And it's resulting changes on our air, our weather, our water, and our ecosystems. And it really then links it to the four climate hazards that I'll talk about in a little bit more detail in this very straightforward way, where increases in greenhouse gases are leading to these climatological effects that we're seeing and the resultant direct and indirect effects on the health of our population. So in this instance, these increases in greenhouse gases are driving more extreme heat events that we can see and the resulting effects of directly heat illnesses and worsening of pre-existing conditions, so worsening of health effects that we already see in our population, and more heat-related mortality. Those are the potential outcomes of increases in extreme heat. But there are also indirect effects that we need to pay attention to because they have, in many cases, just as important effects on our populations. Infrastructure failures, if we are experiencing a heat wave and the power grid goes down because of the stress on it, then we're even less able to cope with that resulting heat wave, and our vulnerable populations are that much more vulnerable to the effects of heat. It also causes strains on essential services, everything from police and fire protection, emergency medical services, all are stretched during these extreme heat events, and it causes challenges for coping with the resultant health impacts. So really this report is trying to make those links that these increases in the climate hazards that we're starting to see have direct and indirect effects on the health of our population, and these are things that we need to get the information out in people's hands so they can start to take action, start to think about ways that we can better adapt to this changing climate and addressing these health impacts before they start happening. So that's just the detailed way that we approached one of them, and we went through this analysis for each of the four climate hazards, but for instance, for interest of time, I'm only going to focus just on the findings of the other three climate hazards that we addressed in the report. Air pollution impacts, we know air pollution can be worsened by extreme heat and other changing climate conditions. Increases in air pollution have been associated with potential increases in chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, so a very serious lung disease that we're seeing more and more of in our population, lung cancer, cardiovascular disease, allergies, and exacerbations in asthma. Allergies in particular is one that we're becoming more and more familiar with. As our growing season lengthens, there's evidence that there's more pollen being released into the air over a longer period of time, and increasing levels of CO2 in the atmosphere apparently is certain plants that produce a great amount of pollen thrive under those conditions much more so. So they're producing even more as a result of that as well. So again, that's not an effect that a lot of people might consider, but it's directly related to the changes that we're seeing. Flood and drought impacts are another area that have direct and indirect effects on health. Drowning and injuries from flash flooding are obviously the first thing one might think about, but also the stresses of being having to be relocated, being removed from your home because of flooding is a significant mental stress and a source of potentially other related health conditions. Waterborne diseases have been associated at times with flooding. It's certainly something we pay a lot of attention to the Department of Health. When wells are flooded with floodwaters, there certainly is a potential for waterborne disease. It causes strains on essential services. Again, the ability to get basic services to people is challenged during times of flooding. And fiscal strains, the costs of floods are enormous, as you all well know. So looking at these types of impacts and trying to consider their impacts on the health of the population is something this report helps establish and lay out some of the information for folks to work with. The last one we touched on was ecosystem threats. We've seen increases in both the numbers and the range of diseases that could be associated with changes in our ecosystem, such as increased ranges of certain ticks and mosquitoes that can carry Lyme disease and West Nile virus, among other diseases, both in the extent and the numbers of cases of diseases have changed in the relatively recent past. Another effect that we're concerned about is the potential for increases in toxins from harmful algal blooms. We've seen that more and more reported. We work closely with our colleagues at the MPCA on those types of instances because they pose risk to the ecosystem, obviously, but our pets and other folks who may be exposed to those types of water. So we're paying attention to that and the potential threat they can represent to drinking water supplies. So that's it. That's the report, and its main active focus is on looking at these climate hazards and creating the linkages to our public health, both looking forward to what we might expect under various scenarios, and then trying to pull that information together. It's not there. It doesn't make recommendations or other conclusions about things to do, but it's pulling the information together to serve as a resource for those who are in a position to take those actions. I want to say a few things about the Vulnerability Report, which is the other report we published in October. That's a report that looks backward. It's really based on our existing data that we've seen and the changes we've seen in our climate leading up to this time. So the climate hazards, again, are similar. Extreme heat that we focused on in this report, extreme heat events, air pollution, vector-borne diseases, and then flooding and flash flooding and drought, so the water-related activities. We focus also on the characteristics in our population that can increase vulnerability to these climate effects. Things like age, education level, income, and health status, all those things can make one more or less vulnerable to changing environmental factors that could be related to climate change. So we did two things in this report. We assembled these vulnerability factors of the population in one set of maps and one set of factors to really look at where are people that may be more vulnerable to the impacts of climate change located. So that is a tool that can be used. So that looks like this. I know the map's kind of hard to see, but really what it did is focused on 15 separate factors that we know are could be related to making one more vulnerable to some of these climate hazards that we could be seeing under a changing climate. And there are things like an aging population, a young population, populations that live in poverty, populations of color, workers who spend most of their time in the outdoors. So if you work outdoors and that's your only occupation, it could make you more vulnerable to having to work on extremely hot days. People with pre-existing conditions such as asthma that we know make them more vulnerable to the impacts of air pollution, for instance. Families with children in poverty. Households with no vehicles. If you don't have a vehicle or access to a vehicle and there's a significant storm event, you may have a more difficult time being able to get to a place of safety. So these are just some of the factors that we looked at, and we developed a composite index to look at these factors together. And really the highlight from the map is that some areas are more vulnerable than others, but the key is that all areas of the state contain vulnerable populations. And if you're a local public health planner, you really need to be aware of where those populations are and what you might need to do to protect those populations during the event of some of these particular climate hazards taking place. So these factors, these vulnerability factors, are not just useful, I think, for climate change. They really can be useful for a range of different policies. You know, we as a department like to talk about health in all policies. So all of our work with regards to whatever where our specific area of focus is needs to take into account the factors of the population and how the policies and programs that we operate can influence, for good or for worse, these vulnerable populations. So I think it's going to be useful information for local planners and state planners as well. It can also help identify where we have areas of health disparities that may need more attention in terms of addressing those health disparities. So, again, this report fits in very well with the department's aim to bring and highlight some of those issues and bring them forward to those who are working in these areas. So in addition to the population vulnerabilities, we also looked at, again, based on past data, where we see these climate hazards most evident. And these are things like extreme heat events, air quality, poor days of poor air quality, incidence of Lyme disease and other vector-borne diseases, flash flood events, other types of flood events, drought, et cetera. So we combine all those factors together. And as you can see, there are some areas of the state that appear to be more vulnerable to these combined effects than others, and that's not really surprising. The Red River Valley, of course, is more prone to flooding, and that would lead them, obviously, to score a little bit higher in this composite hazard risk map. Again, the key, though, is that flash floods can happen anywhere. I don't think we can predict when the next storm, such as that occurred in Duluth a couple of years ago, where the next one's going to happen. But so that's why, again, these maps also have to be used with some degree of caution, because everyone could be vulnerable to some of these particular climate hazards. Again, all this information summarized in both of the reports that are posted on our website and being made available to our fellow state agencies and local planners all across the state. And that's really the next steps that we're going to be taking with this information, is working with our local communities to look at really help them use these tools to do more in-depth local analysis of their own areas, their own populations, so they can determine how best to adapt to the potential of a changing climate and addressing some of the risk factors and the health impacts that could occur as a result. So we're going to take this show on the road. We're anxious to work with others who are promoting this type of work. The convenings that you heard talked about a little bit earlier, we'll be happy to participate in those and provide some of these tools to those who are going to be attending those meetings so that they can see what we found and how they can apply that in their own work locally. And that's very much the focus of our program, is making this information available for those who are taking actions, planning for these actions, so that they can apply the best science that we can bring to the issue. And I think that's about all I had for you today. I'd be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Thank you, Jim. Ed, do you want to follow up?
Mr. Chair, and thank you, Jim, and your team for doing some really great work. I think it's some groundbreaking work that we're leading the country in. And even though this is a health department report, it really is a report for all of us, because the definition of public health is what we as a society do collectively to assure the conditions in which people can be healthy. That definition doesn't talk about doctors and nurses or hospitals or even public health agencies. It says what we as a society do collectively to assure the conditions. And certainly every agency at this table works on those various conditions. So this report is really your report. So that think about all of the projects that you do, be it in parks and or roads or in heating power plants. Think about the impacts that it has on health. When you're planning those health and all policies kinds of approaches, the programs. But also think of us as a health department as bringing some more information to the table when you're discussing what needs to happen, because I think we have some data that really says there's health implications for these, and that might help with some of the policies and programs that you're thinking about doing. And lastly, that vulnerability index. We have some of the greatest disparities in the country, health disparities, but also education disparities and housing disparities and economic disparities. So think about that map. If we're going to be a healthy state, really thinking it health in very broad terms, in terms of quality of life and prosperity, we need to address those disparities. So think about that map when you have any programs or any policies or any initiatives to reduce the, if we have equity at the center point of that, a lot of the decisions that will be made will be a little different than if we just have efficiency or cost as the main driver. We're trying to say that equity should be at the center point of that. And so this report is really your report to be used, and certainly we as a health agency are partners with you in all of the things that you're doing, and use us as best you can.
Other questions? John?
Mr. Chair, and thanks, Ed. And Jim, just looking at that map, it serves as a good refresher in my mind of who local public health is in Minnesota. And just, if you wouldn't mind to characterize, we look at a map like that, and you don't see every county, for example. You see aggregates of counties. Can you just sort of refresh my memory on who local public health entities in Minnesota are?
I can, Mr. Chairman, Commissioner. That our local public health is, I don't know, what's the best way to characterize it? I'm looking at the commissioner.
They're cities, counties, and multi-county units in addition to tribal agencies that come together. We have 52 community health boards, either cities or counties or multi-county units.
And they're really charged with carrying out many of the public health programs that we as the state. I don't want to oversee is almost too strong a word, but they're responsible for carrying them out on the local level where people live and work. And I think that's best where those services are delivered. And so we work with that model. And so this information is going to be intended to provide them, help them, assist them in planning and adapting to a changing environment, carrying out their work at the local level.
I appreciate the number 52 is there's 87 counties in the state. There's 81 watersheds in the state. There's 6 million people in the state. I think that one of the things that I appreciated when I worked at the health department was that aggregation that local government has done to try to address population health issues at the local government level by working with their neighbors. So counties joined together to form a local public health response plan, basically. And I just think it's really an interesting model if the rest of you in state agencies look at that and how we implement programs. It's a different model, and I find it to be really an interesting one because it has served the public health community pretty well. And I just always know that when we face implementation of our efforts, that model builds on some really good history of sort of, I can remember the number, over 2,100 local public health departments once upon a time. Every township, every county, every city could be a health department or a health agency at one point in time, and they went through a process to organize themselves differently. And I think it's really a good way because it directly addresses population health of a given place in the state. So I just... If you haven't ever looked into that from your work in other agencies, it's an interesting model.
Other questions?
Mr. Chair, just in response to that, you know, we also have an advisory committee made up of community health service agencies, community health boards. So we have county commissioners who are really on the boards of health in local communities who advise us. That's probably the most influential advisory committee that we have. So it's a partnership. These are independent health departments. They're not run by us, but we are certainly in partnership with them. So county commissioners are some of my best friends in public health because they make decisions at a local level. So we're in partnership with them throughout the state. And that's, again, for us has been a really good model of that state and local partnership to really accomplish the public health goals that we have.
Kristen and then Brian.
I wondered if there was any scope of insight into mental health or well-being. I know that that's something that is in one of your frameworks. I wonder if there were any insights that you included.
Mr. Chairman, I think we address that as and recognize that as indirect effects of these potential climate hazards, and I think that's important because it's not talked about a lot. Mm-hmm. And if we're not, you know, by identifying it, we're trying to put that at the forefront of thinking of our local public health partners, that addressing the mental health issues that arise from a dislocation from flooding are significant, and in fact, many times more challenging than some of the other issues that are present with such events. So that's really our first step. But we don't have the answers for how to best to address that because that's best left to our local partners to figure that out, who know their communities best. But by identifying that as things that we need to consider. Mm-hmm. We're really hoping to get that as part of the conversation. So rather than just the essentials of food and water and shelter when such events are taking place, that really some consideration needs to be given to the mental health needs of those communities because that's a very important aspect.
Thank you.
Brian?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd just like to underscore Commissioner Ellinger's comment that this isn't just nurses and doctors and hospitals and types of things. We had a presentation by our local public health department talking about Lyme's disease. We're ground zero in northeastern Minnesota, the forested area. That's really where it's all occurring. And just so happened, an older gentleman said, you know, we didn't have these problems a long time ago when we used to burn everything off in the spring. But we can't burn everything off in the spring anymore, everything meaning fields, swamps, hay fields, that sort of thing, because of the burning restrictions being put on early nowadays for prevention of forest fires, obviously. So it's just interesting. If burning restrictions were controlled by the Department of Health, I wonder if they would be different than being controlled by the DNR. It's just an interesting comment that an observation was made by an older gentleman who's seen things change in his 80 years, and that particular person connected the dots up the way he did. I'm not saying it's right or wrong, but I will say that when you burn off a field, there are no ticks left.
I think that Commissioner Landwehr.
I feel an obligation to offer a partial retort here, Mr. Chairman. And I observe that 2018 will be the 100th anniversary of the Hinckley fires. And perhaps there were no ticks at all in 1919. But I'm not convinced that's where we want to get back to, Mr. Chairman. So.
I noticed in our brochure we also have, in our minutes of the last meeting, we had public testimony from Dan Gilchrist, Assistant Director of the University of Minnesota Regional Sustainable Development Partnership, inviting EQB Citizens Board to attend and work with them on climate change mitigation, convening in Greater Minnesota in 2015. Do you see any kind of opportunity to work within the Extension Service as you look at, you know, that map? It seems to me that would be a key and critical partner as you move forward trying to get this information out to the consuming public.
Very much so. I think we are looking for all avenues that we can take advantage of to get this information in the hands of our partners.
Other comments or questions?
Just the last, for the any of my staff that are watching, I'm really interested in going on the road with the health department on this subject because air pollution, while we talk about ozone and particulate matter, is a particular concern in the metropolitan area, that we have areas of the state where we face the potential for non-attainment with the federal and national ambient air quality standards in it. And so this isn't just a metropolitan problem alone. There are places in the state where we have air quality issues growing, and this the population health concerns that that this report identifies for those risks. So I just would love to be a part of that on the road team to mutually share that information, provide people with the background on how we're facing concerns statewide on non-attainment with federal ambient air quality standards. There are some localized reasons for that. There are regional conditions that create those challenges, but essentially we are all a part of the problem, and I'd just love to be able to be a part of that as the health department travels around speaking to that issue.
And Mr. Chairman, Commissioner, just to kind of go full circle on a couple things, what Dan was asking about is highlighted in this memo that Anna drew up for the board, and if you look at the meeting dates are on the bottom there, and so they're really looking for broad-based state participation, so welcome that from the health department and PCA, but you know, climate touches on so many different agencies, so we're really hoping to cast a pretty wide net, and so thank you for your interest.
Mr. Chair, related to that, as we look at Greater Minnesota meetings, one of the concerns I always have is, you know, it's a three-hour meeting, a lot of travel. If we can link it with some other things going on in those areas, that could, you know, we could do more than one thing at a meeting. So I was just, you know, looking at these climate change thing. You know, if there's any way, if it's not these, some other things that we could have at EQB meeting in partnership with some other meetings that really make the trip worthwhile.
Good point. Thank you. Other questions or comments?
Well, I'm very interested in this partnership with the RSDP going around, because one of the major functions of the Sustainable Development Partnerships is to work with communities on local energy projects. And my experience and observation in the communities is that the empowerment of local people to work on efficiency and sustainability is for them a mental health piece for climate change. I know that sounds a little outside the box, but that's my experience, that people feel empowered and reassured by being able to work on these things in the face of climate change. So just wanted to say that.
Good point. All right. If there are no other comments or questions, Jim, thank you very much for educational presentation.
Thank you.
All right. We are at the point of a motion to adjourn. Is right, yes. Is there a motion to adjourn?
Mr. Chairman, just briefly before you do, we did pass out a 10-year strategic plan the department just finished, and welcome to give you any more information on it. It really is a brand new document. Looks at the kind of diverse set of responsibilities we have, identifies some priorities and some strategies we'll be following in the next few years. It's especially useful right now as we go into the session to present a budget and identify the priorities facing the state of Minnesota. So pleased to be able to present it, and hope you enjoy looking at it.
And this, I assume, is a Minnesota moose.
That in fact, we had to actually pay for a Minnesota moose picture, because the moose picture we had was an Alaskan moose, which is completely unsatisfactory. So we had to buy a new moose picture. Yes.
How would one tell the difference?
You simply ask them. Where are you from?
Yeah, we tell by the language they speak.
Size is the first hint.
Really? A valid ID. Okay. That's a big moose.
Yeah. Moose have a way of knowing this, Mr. Chairman. I'm not sure. It may resemble the way dogs know as well. I really don't know.
I think it's time
the
for
the difference
a
between Starbuck and Murdoch, I think, Mr.
Probably,
Chair.
Yes. All right. Is there a motion to adjourn?
So moved.
There is. Is there a second?
Second.
All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Same sign, the motion carries. Thank you very much.
I have a question for you. Is that a record?